And the time is 10 o'clock right here on your community radio station. Do stay tuned for Alternative Currents coming up next with your host, Bella Johnson.
Support for public affairs programming on WERU comes from Coastal Enterprises Incorporated, CEI, a private nonprofit community development organization offering financing and technical assistance to small businesses, social service facilities, and affordable housing projects throughout Maine. 882-7552.
Good morning and welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. A couple of weeks ago, I picked up one of many magazines in my office waiting room and absent-mindedly flipped it open to an article entitled Gadfly Spirituality. Next to the article's first page was a photo of a middle-aged man dressed in a black and silver headband of some Greek design and a white tunic with a cape over his shoulder, trimmed in the same design as the headband. He is posing on the streets of New York City by the entrance to a Times Square subway. I began reading. A gadfly is a biting insect reputed to drive animals mad. 2,500 years ago, the lord of the gadflies was a philosopher, Socrates, whose biting dialogues launched our Western intellectual tradition. But we forget that he was also a spiritual teacher with powerful tools to nurture our souls. As I came upon the next page, here again was this little man in a tunic, this time actively engaged in dialogue with a smiling woman on the street, while others gathered around with bemused expressions on their faces. This time the scene is in front of a newsstand at Times Square itself. A bubble appears over the head of the Socratic figure asking, "How many things are sold here that I do not need?" I was hooked. Reading on, the author and our guest today, Ron Gross, states, "When I explain the headline, Socrates nods sadly. My friend, your countrymen seem to have made the same mistake as we did in my beloved Athens. You have pursued wealth and power at the cost of personal integrity, and you are surrendering your treasured freedoms for the sake of security. And further, I do not want you to be convinced by me. I want you to be convinced by the truth." A breath of fresh air in these troubled times, Ron Gross, author of Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost, is resurrecting Socrates to remind us how many of us have betrayed our democratic ideals and how we can take specific measures to broaden our intellect and nurture our souls through utilizing Socratic principles in everyday living. I'd like to welcome Ron to our show today.
Thank you, Bella. It's a pleasure to talk with you this morning.
And likewise, I'm sure.
Thank you.
The article, by the way, listeners, was from Spirituality and Health. It's a really great place to go to get an intro on this book. This is the April edition of Spirituality and Health. Ron, just how would Socrates observe that we have indeed betrayed these democratic ideals, and what steps can we take to get back on track?
Well, the reason that I go out as Socrates is that I realize that we face very much the kind of situation that Socrates did at the end of his life at the age of 70 when he was brought up on charges and eventually given the hemlock by his fellow citizens and neighbors. We are faced with unprecedented challenges to our democratic society. We've incurred tremendous losses, as his beloved Athens had, which was brought to ruin by the Spartans. And our fellow citizens seem to be losing faith in the values that made them great, critical inquiry, reason, talking together, making decisions in concert, and seem all too willing to hand over their hard-won freedoms to return for the promise of security. And as Socrates and his fellow Athenians learned, when you do that, you end up with neither freedom nor security. So I felt that as I went about the 42nd Street and Broadway as Ron Gross, I felt that the people I were looking at seemed to be asleep, as Socrates found some of his fellow Athenians. They seemed to be obsessed with consuming, whereas when he went to the Agora, the marketplace of Athens, as you said, he frequently would look around and say, "How many things there are here that I do not need." There seems to be an indisposition to focus on on strengthening our souls and thinking for ourselves and growing with others. And it seemed to me that the best way that I could impel my fellows to that and also awaken the Socratic spirit within me was to take on the Socratic persona, to appear as Socrates, and to have people deal with confronting the gadfly in their present-day life.
Yes, you say that, and I quote you, like Socrates, we must define for ourselves what true citizenship means and recognize that dissent may be as patriotic as unthinking obedience.
Oh, I'm so glad you like that quote, Bella. Yes, indeed. Well, that was precisely what Socrates did. He didn't go around telling people what he thought they should think. He went around inviting them to explore their ideas and together to see whether they could come to a better discernment of the truth and of what would be truly helpful to them in their situation and in their society. And that's what I do as Socrates. In that picture in Spirituality Today, Spirituality and Health magazine, I'm not just posing at that subway station. I'm ready to get hard to work with fellow New Yorkers. And within 10 minutes of the moment that that picture was taken, I had around me a group of 25 or so New Yorkers who were taking time out of their frantic day to suddenly stop and ask themselves the question that I had posed, what makes a city great? And we had a marvelous dialogue right there on the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway of that question, which is one that all New Yorkers and to some degree all Americans face in the wake of the tragedy of 9/11. How do we continue to make our country great? What is it that truly constitutes our greatness? And therefore, what do we need to revivify in order to have the kind of renewal that we need?
Right. Ron, how did Socrates become such a prominent figure in your own life?
Well, for me personally, though that's the least important part of it, of course.
Well, it's history. It's interesting.
It started when I was 12 years old, and I noticed that each day before he went to work, my father would take down a rather large tome from the top shelf of the bookcase in our living room, and he would very carefully open it, stretch the spine, and tear out six pages and fold them up in thirds and carry them in his jacket pocket when he left for work. And then when he would come back at night, I'd see him put his keys and his change and wallet on the foyer table, and then he would take out these pages of the book and flatten them out and put them back in the book and put the book back on the top shelf. So one day I finally got up the nerve to ask him what that was all about. I had actually pulled the book down and seen that it was Plato's Dialogues. And I asked him why he did that, and he didn't patronize me. He explained in very straightforward adult terms that in his work, in his daily work, he did not have the opportunity to meet the brightest people. He didn't have a chance to discuss the most interesting ideas, but he realized that for 45 minutes each day on his way to and from work, he could keep company with some of the best and brightest people who ever lived, people who had real conversations, didn't just shout their views at each other, but spoke eloquently and with articulateness, and then really listened and understood each other and achieved mutual understanding. And that was what the world that he would like to live in, and so he could live in it for that time. I couldn't help but note subsequently that Socrates seemed to have had an impact on him, because he had the knack of asking just the right question to impel an interesting conversation, or to propel a conversation in the right direction, or to indicate the direction for the solution of a problem that we faced in the family or in his business. So I could see that Socrates had made a really profound impact on his life. And then a couple of years after that, when I began asking more questions about Socrates, he took me to my first Broadway show, which was a play called Barefoot in Athens, which was a play that portrayed the life of Socrates. And there I saw my hero tramping around on stage barefoot, and I didn't wear sandals or shoes for a week after that because I was so taken with that. Pulled a sheet off the bed and was walking around. And so to some degree, I've been pursuing that ever since. All of my books are built on the Socratic ideal of lifelong learning and the pursuit of truth in the company of friends. And that's what I now try to do even more dramatically and I think more effectively by having people confront Socrates himself.
Right. You know, one of the things I found interesting was reading that Socrates never wrote anything down. I mean, you mentioned Plato's dialogues.
That's so important in terms of our fixation on the written word. Socrates truly believed that philosophic understanding only occurs when people talk face-to-face, or at least mouth-to-ear, as we are now, rather than by trying to a person going off alone and trying to codify all of their thoughts and put them down in writing and then give the book to other people. He loved books and reading, but he always used to say that the trouble with a book was that when you read the book, when you were reading the book and you had a question and you asked the book a question, the book just kept repeating the same thing over and over and over.
Well, some people do that too.
Well, yeah, true. But those are people who probably are too influenced by books and not influenced enough by dialogue.
Right.
So the fact is that we wouldn't know anything about Socrates whatsoever. He wouldn't even be a footnote in history since he wrote nothing. There's not a page, not a line in any library in the world that is written and signed by Socrates. The only way we know about him is that a couple of his friends, particularly Plato and Xenophon, thought so highly of the time they had spent with him and felt that they enjoyed and benefited and loved the conversation so much that they devoted a good part of their lives to documenting them and writing them afterwards. So we can, by reading those dialogues or by reading my book Socrates Way, we can walk with Socrates and actually hear exactly what he said at the most dramatic moments in his life, and we'll talk about some of those later, I'm sure. And the significance of this is that it's a tribute to Socrates' gift for friendship. Friendship was probably his single prime value, and it's highly significant then that we only know about him because of the devotion of his friends, and that in fact the books through which we know about Socrates don't have titles like the usual books of philosophy. They're not called Treatise on Logic or Prolegomenon to Any Future Metaphysics, but they have titles like Critias, Protagoras, Gorgias. In other words, simply the names of friends of Socrates, a friend who happened to play a principal part in the dialogue on that particular day. So that if I were Socrates and Plato was listening to this dialogue and he was particularly impressed, he might write a dialogue called the Bella. And then we would add that to the Meno and the Gorgias and the Protagoras. So the very titles of the books through which we know what we know about Socrates are tributes to his gift for friendship and to the fact that friendship and dialogue, communion with others, was his principal value in life.
And relationships, I mean, I do a lot of programs on that very topic because they're so complex. Why do you think people are so afraid of others' differing opinions? How do you think we can better just allow these differing opinions to coexist? Because this is kind of what Socrates did. You know, he was challenged, and then he listened, and then there was dialogue.
Yes, it's a wonderful question, Bella. And I think that first of all, we have to recognize that it's quite natural, given our egos and some of our false concepts of self-esteem, that we tend to resist being someone taking a critical view of something we've said or pointing out a fallacy in our thinking. We should actually welcome it. And at our best we do, of course, when we really have a major problem to solve or challenge to face. If we're smart, we engage in the kinds of conversation called brainstorming and creative problem solving in which we truly welcome other people's input, even if it contradicts some of the things that we're saying or thinking, because we realize at that point that we need the effect, the potency that can only come from a true group, a group truly working together, and different people truly listening to each other's perspectives. That all of us are smarter than any of us, and when the chips are down, as I say, if we're smart, we tend to realize that and to use specific methods and place ourselves in situations in which we're going to be able to hear other people. One way in which people do that on an informal level is Socrates cafes. There's a national movement of people at the grassroots just trying to reinvent the art of conversation by getting together in libraries or senior centers or bars or living rooms and conducting their own Socrates' conversations. There's a book that's a kind of companion book to mine called Socrates' Cafe by Christopher Phillips. And together, these two books are a wonderful introduction to expressing the Socratic spirit in yourself, as well as joining with others to create situations and contexts in which you're going to be able to do what you're describing, really listen to and value and benefit from different points of view, even if they contradict your own.
Right. Yeah, I think once we begin to do it, it becomes less threatening in some way. I think, well, for example, growing up, I was considered to be such an excellent student, but it was largely due to my learning to be such a good people pleaser and to still my active inquiring mind and give the teachers the answers they were looking for. So even to this day, I still remember being kicked out of Sunday school for asking too many questions. It made the teacher uncomfortable because he didn't have the answers, or the scriptures that he was relating to didn't necessarily answer my questions. How
There's two wonderful points there, if I may. There's two wonderful points that you wrapped together there that I'd like to just tease apart. One is the fact that the, quote, good student, the student who gets the A's, frequently is sabotaging their own education,
right,
as you confessed admirably that you were doing when you just provided the teacher with what the teacher wanted to hear. And that on the other hand, the second point is equally important, that the teacher who is a real pain in the butt to the teacher is frequently the student who may be the one student in the class who truly will become an inquirer, a scholar, a scientist in that field themselves, because they are the student for whom who refuses, as you were when you were doing that in Sunday school, who refuses to accept the answer just to please the teacher, who truly wants to understand and know why the answer is what it is, and to examine it critically. And so just as in your case, you were evicted from that class, whereas it's quite it's obvious from what happened afterwards, from where you've gone from there, that you were one of the, or perhaps the only person in that class who truly had a vocation for spirituality and who truly was going to make her own wonderful discoveries and conduct her own practice in the field, whereas the others who were pleasing the teacher were not really taking it seriously and perhaps never did manifest their own spirituality.
Well, I also wonder if they were really listening. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. You bet. But those are two awfully good points about students and about, in general, about learning. So I'm so glad you pointed that out. As always, our own personal experiences are so pregnant with meaning once we step back and examine them.
Yeah. It was painful at the same time, though. I mean, being ostracized from my peers, and, you know, I felt like I couldn't go back to church again because it was too embarrassing, but it didn't stop me. And I, with my own children, I've really encouraged them to formulate questions than, you know, rather than just simply parrot back the safe answers the teachers were looking for. And, you know, it's been good for them overall. They wouldn't change a thing, but they certainly did encounter some challenging, you know, situations and being accepted by their peer group, or just being able to be listened to in the same valuable way that they listen to others.
Exactly. It's a real problem in schools, of course. And I can only imagine how much you foster the right attitude in your kids. And it is interesting how that's reacted to by fellow students and by the teachers. Right.
Yeah. You mentioned how relevant Socrates' principles are in your own life, certainly, and stating that they're almost demanding that you apply them. Often isn't that true? You know, we teach something, then we really get to learn it.
Exactly.
But how have these principles really forced you to walk your talk?
Well, I've, like most of us, been given the hemlock.
And you survived.
Right, yes. Well, fortunately, it was metaphoric, and I certainly have not suffered the way some have for standing up for their convictions, but on several occasions in my life, I've had issues have arisen in organizations with which I've been involved, where I felt that I had to take a stand. The one that I talk about in the book was when I was on the board of one of the national voluntary health organizations, at a time when the federal government, this was quite a number of years ago, the federal government under President Nixon was undermining prenatal care facilities throughout the country by defunding them, by removing the funding, the kind of thing that's now we're now in danger of again. So since the organization which I was on the board of was devoted to trying to get mothers to be the kind of care that they needed, it seemed to me that the actions of the federal government were going to undo all of our work, and that there was no way we could achieve our goal unless we openly contested these policies. But at that time, this organization did not want to get involved in, quote, politics, unquote. So I started agitating on the board and organizing a few sympathetic board members, and pretty soon I was railroaded off the board and at a meeting that I didn't go to. And the net result was that personally I certainly failed to shift the opinion, but within a year of my leaving the board, the organization did thankfully see the light and begin to take a role in opposing the policies that were undoing all of their good work. And I did get a very gratifying letter eventually from the president that I had played some small role. As they stepped over my body, they couldn't help but wonder whether they might have made a mistake, and eventually they realized that they did. So in that case, suffered from which was a pretty easy to take compared with what some people have suffered in defense of their convictions. But it was an illustration of the way in which my convictions compelled me to do what I had to do, even though it wasn't what I particularly wanted to do.
Right. You really embodied Socrates in that sense, too, because you speak of in the books that, and the article as well, I believe that after his death by hemlock, they kind of stood back, the crowd stood back and realized they'd made a mistake, or as time went by, they realized more and more that, gee, maybe they shouldn't have done that. And I like the way you describe the process of the trial, that, what was it, 500 peers were the judges, and they'd all put a little rock inside of a container to judge guilty or innocent?
Yes, well, the reason that they picked that they appointed such large juries was simply to avoid bribery. Because bribery was so rampant in 5th century Athens that if you had a small jury, you could be pretty sure that a rich plaintiff or litigant would bribe them. So if you had 500, the feeling was that was going to be too many people to be bribed.
It would be a good practice nowadays, I think.
Yes, it could well be, indeed. Exactly, right. But you know, these principles that Socrates lived by, as you know, in the book I delineate the 7 principles, which I think...
Yes, I want to get into those at some point, too.
I think any one of us can start using today in our lives to very good effect, to ask great questions, think for yourself, speak the truth, grow with friends. They're very simple. Strengthen your soul. They're things that many of your listeners, I'm sure, already do every day. But what I found is that knowing Socrates as a friend and as a coach... as I hope people can through the book and through the website, we should mention the website, since we provide good samples of the book free there. That's www.socratesway.com. The getting to know Socrates and getting to use some of the techniques that he used is a way of expressing the Socratic spirit in all of us. Because the important thing about this book isn't even Socrates, as he'd be the first to say. It is. The fact that in each of us is a Socratic spirit, is a spirit of question asking, of independence of mind, of communion with other people, strengthening our soul, and it's that he can help us to manifest and to actualize.
Now, we've talked a lot about the voice, the outward expression, the critical, questions, and really speaking up. But, you know, being on radio has really made me aware of what any host dreads. It's called dead airspace, or long pauses with no sound. And I realized I somehow feared this dead airtime all along while growing up. As you pointed out, though, and I've discovered later in life, reflection is a Socratic asset.
Oh, indeed, yes. And it's taken me a while to learn that too, Bella, that that people frequently need time to process what they're hearing or what you're saying or what they themselves are saying, and that pauses like that are necessary and highly beneficial. And as we all know, when we're talking to a group, it's absolutely essential when you say, particularly if you say something that is provocative, to simply take the time to let it sink in, and that when you do that, people will eventually, after what seems like a long time to you if you're standing in front of a group, but is actually quite a short time because each person in the group is thinking their own thoughts and is quite busy doing that, that reactions will start to come forth. And so when I dialogue as Socrates, I'm never concerned about a pause. If I have a group and pose a question, what is happiness? I do not expect to get an instant answer. I want people to stop and think and reflect and meditate and take just as long as they like.
And do they?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I invite it, of course.
Yeah, because
sure.
I think often it's just the pace of the culture, you know, that we don't feel like we can really do that much. So I really had to pace myself with it, just allow myself to do it, you know, and allow other people to do it as well.
That's interesting because, frankly, with your great gifts, I would have thought that would have come so naturally to you. You know, I know that I had to learn it, but I would have thought that it would have been second nature to you because of your terrific empathy with what's going on in other people. So that's so interesting to me that you needed to become conscious of it too.
Well, I think that's the good student, you know, the good daughter.
Ah.
The early conditioning. And that brings me to the question that I have about Socrates, who is usually referred to as this great thinker. Mm-hmm. But the title of your article in Spirituality and Health is Gadfly Spirituality. It seems common these days to see spirituality and thinking placed on kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, almost like the mind will get you in trouble if you use it too much. But I, too, am a fan of honing the intellect as a spiritual tool. Can you speak a little bit about how you view this matter?
Oh, certainly. Well, as you rightly say, a great discovery for me was that Socrates, who we usually think of as, from our school training about him, as the master logician, the master of the syllogism, the critical thinker, the man who could, and he was all of those things, of course, the man who could discern mistakes in other people's logic, who insisted on definitions that were truly, I won't say precise definitions, but it was better than that, but definitions that were truly comprehensive of important words like soul and friendship and power. So we think of him as a kind of left-brain intellect who dealt in words and logical distinctions. But as I came to know him more and more, I came to realize that just as important to him were values like friendship, which we've talked about, authenticity, personal spirituality, care of the soul, and that in fact he did a great deal of his thinking and communicating through images, which you're so adept at. The image of the cave, the image of the gadfly, the image of the fiery circle of friends, the image of the chariot drawn by two steeds. We'll probably talk about some of these. Both in thinking and communicating and in his own spiritual development, Socrates' values and his ways of delineating ideas and communicating ideas and understanding the world was quite right-brained. And so basically, I think what's wonderful about using him as a model for bringing forth our own powers is that he did combine the right and left brain. He was truly a whole-brain thinker who was able to enlist both the rational and the intuitive and imagistic parts of the brain. And I think that was what makes him such a fine mentor for us, that he was neither just one or just the other.
Right. Yeah, it makes it real clear in your book. I want to take a little break, give you a chance to catch your breath and grab a glass of water.
Okay.
We are speaking today on Alternative Currents with Ronald Gross, author of Peak Learning, but today we're speaking about his book, Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost, published by Tarcher Putnam. You're listening to Alternative Currents on Community Radio, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Again, this is Bella Johnson, host of Alternative Current, speaking with Ronald Gross, author of Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost. Ron, we're talking about Socrates being both a left and right-brained kind of guy.
Right.
And one thing I found interesting is in the book you speak of how to speak the truth, logos, pathos, and ethos. Can you cover those? And how they're relevant to how he communicated with people.
Well, that, of course, is an excellent illustration of the use of the whole brain. Logos, of course, is the artful use of words to articulate the concept fully and accurately. Pathos means bringing to bear the emotional aspect, bringing in the full use of affect. And feelings, so that the idea is informed with feeling states and spiritual states that give it full resonance. And then ethos, of course, is your integrity, is the authenticity with which you speak these views, so that they're not just something that you learn from a teacher, but something that you have proven in your life. And that was the kind of diction that Socrates was a master of. The Athenians had a wonderful way of characterizing this when they distinguished between different oratorical orators. They used to say that when Pericles speaks, the crowd goes away saying, "What a wonderful speaker he is." When Demosthenes speaks, the crowd rouses itself and says, "Let us march to war." So it was an expression of the different uses of rhetoric.
Right. Yeah, so many speakers would virtually put me to sleep and do. It's hard for me to really sit in a lecture. But I can't imagine being bored listening to someone like that speak, because one, in my mind, always feels valued when those principles are in action. Even just speaking with you today and the kind of feedback that you give me back as a host, it's just always validating. It's always valuable.
Oh.
And it feels real good to speak with you in that sense. So I think he certainly must have been a good friend.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Bella. That is that's a great compliment. And, of course, your gift as an interviewer is to do the same thing with your guests. My publisher arranged for a great number of interviews, not this one. This one, of course, was at your initiative, which is probably why it's so good. But my publisher engaged one of those companies that that gets you 100 interviews, radio interviews around the country.
Oh, sure.
And that turned out to, while it sells books, it frankly, it turns out to be a pretty depressing thing, because most of the interviewers in these programs have no understanding of the book whatsoever, and really don't even have any interest in learning about it during the interview.
Right.
They are absolutely just phoning it in, as it were.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be pretty depressing, because you realize that while you're reaching a lot of people, you're reaching them at a very thin level, if unless you can lift it above the level that the host of the program sets. Well, with you, it's a cinch, because we're at the same level, and it's just wonderful to talk with someone who understands, wants to understand, and has her own views to contribute that enrich the understanding. So you are, to my mind, the ideal kind of person to do a program like this, and that's based on about 100 interviews with people who 98% of whom were not.
Well, thank you. So even when you practice your Socratic principles, sometimes they're not received, or does it take that listening or that kind of willingness to enter into dialogue the way that Socrates did?
Oh, it absolutely does. One of the things we don't realize when we read the Socratic dialogues in school is that we're reading the accounts of perhaps 20 days in a lifetime spent in the Agora. Every single day of his life, Socrates got up early in the morning, went up to the Parthenon to pay tribute to Athena. Socrates and his father had worked on the Parthenon, so he could feel his father's influence. His father was a stonemason. But then Socrates would go to the Agora, the great marketplace at the foot of the Acropolis, and spend the day there talking to people. And the dialogues that we have are just maybe 20 of those encounters out of an entire lifetime spent in the Agora. And so I'm sure I know there were days when Socrates was hardly listened to, and where he felt he had no impact whatsoever. And to me, that too is a great lesson, that what matters is going at it day after day and sticking with it, not just the high points that are worth recording and that might come down the centuries. So that's the great lesson of Socrates, that these were not just moments in his life, but that he did this every single day.
Right. The other thing I really like about his approach, and your approach as well, is just kind of looking at these dialogues is, I'm a perplexed soul inspiring other perplexed souls to inquire within themselves. I think it's a real open way of looking at dialogue and invites more dialogue, rather than saying I'm the expert on this, which is what, you know, some of the rhetoric we're kind of used to hearing from corporate America and the media, that, you know, listen to the expert. But there's going to be an expert who is going to have the exact opposite opinion, as we found out again and again. I think of medicine, for example, where you've got someone saying, you know, this particular protocol for cancer or diet or whatever is going to work, and you'll read somewhere the exact opposite. You know, eat no meat, eat all meat,
right.
You know, do an
yes.
Atkins diet, do a no meat diet, you know. So, I mean, and they have equally valid supporting kind of research.
Right, of course, Bella, you're absolutely right. Well, that is why the Socrates cafes have become so popular. In the one that my wife and I conduct here in our community, we say on the announcement of each session that we're going to be discussing a topic on which you are as much of an expert as anyone, and we're going to really listen to each other and have our views expanded and enriched by the different perspectives that different people bring to the discussion. And indeed, it works awfully well, but it is a new experience for most people, because for most people, it's the only group that they go to where there isn't an authority figure who is presenting what everyone else is supposed to accept, perhaps with a few Q&A at the end, question and answer.
Right.
But to start a group right off with the fact that we're sitting in a circle, there's no leader, everyone's view is as important as everyone else's and needs to be listened to with that kind of respect. However, with the caveat that each person in the group has to be willing to have their views disputed, contested, critically examined. So it's not just a matter of accepting anything that anybody says. It's a matter of using your own intelligence and your own experience to criticize what you're hearing and to know that that's all right. That gets back to that point of yours about the whether people are willing to have their views criticized and to accept a different point of view. And that's probably the most beneficial thing that comes out of Socrates cafes is people having an opportunity to practice really hearing other people telling them things that they can use to correct their own views if they wish, and to take a broader view of the issue being discussed.
Exactly right. Yes, you speak about engaging in dialogue with anyone, anywhere, as being one of the things that Socrates did. And certainly if we say, well, we're only going to listen to this select group of experts, it kind of eliminates a lot of people with a lot of real unique perspectives.
Right. What I try to do in each chapter of the book, and there's a chapter for each of these principles, ask great questions, think for yourself, grow with friends, is first of all, I take the reader right next to Socrates, and we go with him to the marketplace and watch him wield his famous Socratic method, or we go with him to a party in the evening, which he did most evenings. He was a great party animal, and it's very interesting, as you know, to find out why and how important these parties were. And they were pretty. Some of them were pretty wild affairs. We go with him to the theater. We are with him in his cell the night before he has to take the hemlock and hear his friend, his oldest friend Crito, propose the plan for his escape and why Socrates chose not to escape and to stay and take the hemlock. So first we have experiences with Socrates. Then I have dramatic stories of people in modern times,
yes,
such as Carl Jung, who found Socrates an important mentor. And then, the most important, there are dozens of exercises that people can start doing immediately to put these principles into action in their families, in their offices, in their at social events, things that you can do the very day that you read them in the book. You can close the book, go out and find an opportunity to put one of these into practice, not by pretending to be Socrates, but just by a simple way of jostling a conversation onto higher ground. So it's really a book that brims with ways to live your life a little richer and a little more authentically every single day.
Well, you definitely ask some really good questions, and it seems at the end of every chapter you're really asking for someone to engage with the material. You know, there's lines with questions and, you know, room for answers and thoughts. Or thoughts rather than answers.
Right.
Trying to get them thinking. And one of the questions I really liked that you asked, when you mentioned these everyday people who have knowingly or unknowingly practiced Socratic methods in their lives, you ask, you know, who are these carriers of the flame in your own life?
Mm-hmm.
And I think of one professor I had at Vermont College, and she's had such an impact on my life. I went back as an adult learner, and she kept asking, what are your questions?
Uh-huh.
And I was, you know, she wasn't giving us a topic, for heaven's sake. I'm like, what are your questions? I'm thinking, what is she talking about?
Uh-huh.
It took me almost 2 years to really understand what she was trying to get out of me at that point. And it has permeated my entire life and reoriented me to a more self-respectful and authentic way of being.
Oh, Bella, what a wonderful tribute to a teacher. Can we say who she is?
Her name is Dana Mann,
mm-hmm.
And she was a psych professor and just a humanist and Jungian, and just in the true sense of being a humanist, just really looking at authenticity and genuine ways of expression. And she really did, in a sense, give me back my voice.
That's absolutely wonderful. Well, as you know, I tell the story in the chapter called Know Thyself, because that's one of these principles, of course. It all starts with knowing yourself. And to illustrate someone who exemplified that in modern times, I tell the story of Maury Schwartz,
yes,
the teacher of Mitch Albom's, in his wonderful book Tuesdays with Maury,
right,
about this. Pardon me. About this very successful journalist, sports writer, who goes back and spends time with his old professor, who I take it was much like the teacher that you just described for Mitch Albom, but he finds that his old teacher is terminally ill and resolves to spend as much time as he can with him. And the book is the account of his visits with Mari in the last weeks and days of his life. And Mari functions there exactly just as your teacher did, as a Socratic teacher, as a true Socratic teacher, posing questions, asking Albom what his questions are, and also posing questions like, have you become what you were destined to be? Are you at peace with yourself? Have you found someone to share your heart with? And it's a wonderful portrayal of the meaningfulness of a Socratic teacher. In another part of the book, I do the same thing with some experiences of Fritz Perls, you may recall.
Yes, I do. And the picture, by the way, of Murray was just, it's so touching. It's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, yeah, so the book, just as we've been saying about Socrates, you might, most books about Socrates are pretty heavy going and are pretty philosophical in the sense of being discursive and verbal and abstract and conceptual. But this book, even to having photographs of the people who we're talking about, and a lot of illustrations, of course, to bring you right there into Socrates' world of 5th century Athens, is very human and very warm and really puts you in the presence of the people who we're talking about.
Yes, definitely it does. I would not like you to talk about some of the little myths of Socrates, like the cave, the little story of the cave. I just found that so meaningful.
Oh, yes, the cave is wonderful. And when one of the things I do when Socrates appears in more formal presentations, such as on college campuses, which he does a lot, university and college campuses, I actually take people to the cave via creative visualization, or Socrates does. But the cave, as your listeners probably recall, but I'll just fill in some of the details. Socrates evokes an image of prisoners who have spent their entire lives in an underground cave, completely shut out from the upper world that we live in, and they're chained to their seats and watching shadows flitting on the wall of the cave in front of them. There's a big bonfire behind them, which they can't see, and puppeteers are moving different shapes between the fire and them so that all the prisoners can see are the shadows of these puppets on the wall. And these prisoners, of course, think that that is all there is to reality, and they spend their days debating over, they've gotten very good at looking at these shadows, and they can tell one from another, and they discuss different, how they fit into different categories and what their significance is. But of course, they have no idea that there's anything in the world except these shadows. It begins to sound a little bit like our couch potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
these prisoners can't even switch channels. Well, then one day, one of the prisoners is released from his bondage and is taken back past the bonfire and up and out into our world. Of course, you can imagine how that feels to suddenly come up out of this world of darkness into the light. But eventually, the prisoner becomes acclimated to the world, our world of light. And then the issue arises of whether he should go back down to tell the other prisoners what he's discovered. And if he does decide to go back down, what the other prisoners' reactions will be, how he'll try to describe it and what they will say to him and what their attitudes will be. And I'm purposely not indicating any answers to this, because in doing it via a creative visualization, I, of course, invite people to express how they would feel as that prisoner or as one of the prisoners who is hearing the account of the upper world from a prisoner who has been enabled to see it. Now, that image of the cave and the one prisoner who is able to see reality and then come back and try to share it has been referred to by philosophers down the ages. It's probably the most frequently cited image of enlightenment, of the ascent to enlightenment, and the problems of trying to share what one has learned on one's spiritual journey, because of course it's metaphorical, not literal. It it so invites reflection and meditation as to the problems that we all have, both in trying to get a better grip on reality ourselves and then trying to communicate the little bits that we've achieved to others to hopefully help them. It's a wonderful parable, and it's an illustration of how Socrates used non-logical, non-visual images to express some of his profoundest understanding of reality and delusion.
Yes, it's kind of like a Native American way, or known as a Native American way, where, you know, the answers are given via stories. There aren't any pat answers.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, it's wonderfully effective, and it's the kind of thing that Socrates does when he deals with a group of students or faculty or both. Socrates has been wonderfully effective as a way in which students and teachers on a campus can initiate dialogue about the learning process and about the experience that they're both going through together. Socrates was at a law school in Boston a couple of weeks ago, where the students and the faculty came together for the first time, and with the inspiration of Socrates, they were able to discuss how the teaching in the law school might transcend the very formalistic, functional teaching that is characteristic of law schools, and actually the professors might begin to relate to the students as human beings and not just as numbers on an attendance sheet. And so it really was a stirring change in the culture of that institution.
I imagine the learning might be increased a little bit as well.
Indeed, yeah.
The uptake of information. I want to make sure that we touch on these seven master keys that you speak of in your book. Yes, and also the Socrates' famous method. So however you want to lay that out. I can't believe how quickly the time's gone by, and
I know,
I'm looking at the
wonderful
clock. But yes, it is.
Well, let's just rattle off the seven keys again. They are know thyself, ask great questions, think for yourself, challenge authority, grow with friends, speak the truth, and strengthen your soul. And if those are themes that resonate with listeners, then this may be a good book for them, because if those are things they'd like to do with their mind or are already doing but feel that they can benefit from some strengthening and some inspiration and some practical techniques that work marvelously well, then they may find what they're looking for. And a quick way to test it would be to go to the website www.socratesway.com. And take a look there. Of course, you'll see Socrates coming out of that subway station as you described him at the beginning of this interview. But there's also a substantial free material from the book which should enable listeners to judge whether the book might be worth getting from the library. So those are the seven principles. And the first one really is Socrates' great method. That is, his famous method was to ask questions rather than to tell people what he thought, let alone what he thought they should think, and get them to think for themselves more productively than they had ever thought possible. Interestingly, Bella, he learned this method from his mother. Socrates' father, as I mentioned, was a sculptor who worked on the Parthenon, and his mother was a midwife. And as a young person, Socrates spent many days going out with his mother and watching her perform this wonderful work of helping women to bring new life into the world. And at around the age of 40, he realized that was his vocation too, that he too was a midwife, but that he was a midwife of ideas, of the mind. He was a midwife of the mind, and that his role in life, his destiny, was to try to help people to bring forth their best ideas so that one can see his constant questioning of people as the equivalent of his mother saying, push, push.
Yeah. One picture worth 1,000 words. I mean, it definitely, right. The images must have impressed him at that
exactly,
early time.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So he always said that he followed in the footsteps of both his mother and his father because he was a midwife of the mind who spent his life, as his father did, sculpting. Only Socrates was sculpting his own life. Was his the great work that he was working on shaping and polishing and refining throughout his entire life. So that was his famed method. And in the book, of course, I provide about a dozen ways to use his method for everything from improving your relationship by asking the single best question that you can ask about your primary relationship. To improving productivity in the workplace, because Socrates does that too. Last week, Socrates spent a day in the offices of a software firm in what's called Silicon Alley, which is Manhattan's version of Silicon Valley. And this little software company had some problems in communication between its technicians and its managers and salespeople. And Socrates was able to help them straighten things out in a way that nothing else had, because you couldn't get their attention by just trying to teach them. But when Socrates began asking key questions, it suddenly resolved some issues that had been undermining productivity in this place for several years. So in the book, there are plenty of methods to use, both in personal and family life and in business and the professions, for improving your performance by using the Socratic method.
Right. Again, from the book Socrates Way by Ronald Gruss, whom we're speaking with today, Socrates' famous method on page 53 of the book, one, choose a statement widely accepted as self-evident or unquestionable. Two, now treat the statement as if it were false. Look for situations in which the statement would not be true. Three, when you find such exceptions, you know the definition is inadequate. Four, clearly the original proposition must be modified to accommodate these exceptions. And five, continue this process by seeking other situations that clarify the concept. By this process of correcting inadequate concepts, you will approach more and more closely a truly adequate idea of what you are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a synopsis, I think, of those.
And, you know, it sounds abstract, but as you know, in the book I immediately give an example of how it applies to a very commonplace concept like friendship. A California sociologist did a study of friendship in which she discovered that the group of people she was studying, each person meant something completely different about friendship and about what being a friend meant and about who their friends were. There was absolutely no correlation. Which illustrates how in the most everyday, intimate, personal relations, this need to clarify what different people mean by a concept, right, and to make sure that we are getting to the essence of it can undermine all of our efforts to achieve our values.
Absolutely.
If we're not clear on what friendship is for us, then we're going to spend an awful lot of time fumbling around and not getting the results that we want. So it's really it sounds kind of abstract, but it's really very, very practical.
Right, a way to ferret out the different perceptions that people have, because we indeed all have our unique perceptions and understandings of the spoken or written word.
Exactly, right.
One thing I wanted to touch on, Ron, before we close, is your idea of elders as gadflies. I just found so wonderful, because we really just so throw away our elders in this society. Not all of us, certainly, but collectively, I think there's an element there. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you picked up on that, Bella, and I absolutely couldn't agree with you more. I think of elders as facing the challenge of using what I call their ageless spirit. I believe that the experience of a lifetime is an absolutely invaluable resource that, quite frankly, is tragically lost each time a person dies, as we all must eventually. And so I think that it is absolutely, from the spiritual point of view, so important for each older person to find ways to express some of the things that they have learned, to use those things to enrich the lives of others, to serve in new ways, that they're more able to now that they are out from under the lash of economic pressures. Hopefully, I see the older people as possibly the richest resource that the country has for becoming more civilized, more decent, more equitable, more humane, and just plain more interesting. If we change our attitudes towards them, and if they are empowered to express and put to use and to enjoy all of the incredible powers that they have, so that nothing could be more important. And from that point of view, Socrates again is a nice model because he reached his peak at the age of 70 at his trial. He was never in better form. He could, he would have continued to grow were it not for the hemlock, which was his choice. So he is an excellent model of how to make the most of the last third of life.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Ron. We have run out of time, but we have been speaking with Ronald Gross, author of Socrates' Way. Check it out. It is published by Tarcher Putnam, or you can find it on the web, www.socratesway.com. Thanks so much, Ron, and best to you.
Thank you, Bella. A pleasure.